supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Support for Voices in the Family is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. You know, for people suffering from mental illness, navigating through everyday life can be an invisible challenge that is as crippling, if not more, than any other disability. From hopelessness, helplessness, job loss, their experiences are often clouded by complexities that most don't see and most can't comprehend. But for those of us close to someone with mental illness, the hurdles they face are echoed in our own lives. And with more than 57 million Americans affected by mental illness, that's almost one in four. Its pervasiveness affects each of us in some way. When the right treatment seems out of reach and difficult to pay for, how can families be there for their loved ones? How can we help others see past the stigma of mental illness and get our loved ones the help they need? Well, to begin this two-part series of Living with Mental Illness, we're going to talk today about its impact on families. In the first part of our show, we'll be joined by Pete Early. He's a former Washington Post reporter who chronicles his son's experience with mental illness in his book, Crazy, A Father's Search Through America's Mental Health Madness. This was nominated as one of two finalists for the Pulitzer Prize. Later on in the show, we'll hear from Jay Members, a Philadelphia man who's got a personal story to tell about his own mental illness and the road to recovery. And of course, we'd like to hear from you. Our number is 888-477-9499. Give us a call if you had or are having your own personal experience with mental illness. Pete Early, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Dr. Gottlieb, for having me. I appreciate it.
Sure. Please call me Dan.
Okay.
Take me back, Pete, to when your son, Mike, started to have his first psychotic episodes. There was a major one during his final year in college in New York. Tell us what happened.
That's exactly correct. He was in New York. I thought he was doing fine, and all of a sudden his older brother called me and said, Mike is crazy. And I raced to New York, and during the four-hour ride from my home in Virginia to New York, and then I picked him up and back, it was just excruciating. You know, he hadn't slept for 5 days. He was convinced God had him on a special mission. And he said to me, Dad, how would you feel if someone you love killed himself? And then he would laugh 1 minute at the silliest thing, and then he'd be sobbing the next. And I raced him to emergency room because I didn't know where else to take him. And I took him to one near our house, and the nurse rolled her eyes while Mike was talking gibberish about how God had him on a special mission. And then we were taken to a room where we were told to wait, and we waited for 4 hours. Finally, Mike said he'd had enough. He was going to leave, and I said, hang on. I raced out. I flagged down a doctor. And Dan, I'll never forget how that doctor came in the room. He came in with his hands up, and he said, I can't help your son. I said, you haven't even examined him. And he told me that the nurse had told him that my son thought all pills were poison, which was true. And under Virginia law, which is similar to all states' laws, a person can't be required to take medication or undergo treatment until they're in imminent danger or they pose an immediate danger to themselves or others. And the fact we'd been in a room for 4 hours and hadn't hurt each other was proof there was no danger. And then he said to me, Mr. Early, you bring your son back after he tries to kill you or he tries to kill someone else.
Yeah, I remember a quote in your book, Pete. You said your experience, and this is the experience of most parents, where a child has a severe mental illness. Your quote was, my son was crazy and getting worse with each passing moment, and I couldn't get anyone to help him. And I guess that's an ongoing feeling.
You know, I'll break away from my story right now because my son ultimately gets arrested. But what this is not only my story. You know, I was in Philadelphia about 2 months ago giving a speech to the local NAMI group, National Alliance on Mental Illness. After I did, I usually sign books, and a number of people come up and tell me their story. I had two people coming up in tears, which isn't unusual, because their son had killed themselves. And then they looked at me and they said, you know, we're both psychiatrists, and we couldn't get our son help in this system. Now, to me, that says volumes about how, and I named my book Crazy not because of my son and people like him, but because of our crazy system. It just is broken down.
Pete, let's try to put a human face on Mike. I want to get to know him a little bit. What was he like in the family before this
all happened? Well, I'm really glad, Dan, you want to get to know him because, you know, here's part of the problem, and then I'll answer your question. My son's had six psychiatrists. You know, only one has known anything but his name and his symptoms, and that's because psychiatrists are told these are organic brain disorders, and all he had to do is figure out what pill to take and stick it in their mouth. But, you know, this is a person, and treating the brain requires treating the heart. And he was the middle of three children. He always walked to the beat of a different drummer. He's very artistic, you know, but we didn't see anything that made us even think about mental illness. The very first sign was during his senior year, about a year before the breakdown I just discovered.
Senior year in high school or college?
No, this is in college. He was 22, and he called me up one day, Dan, and he said, I took some homeless people out to eat breakfast. And I thought, well, that was generous of you. That was nice of you. You know, I wish you'd watch your money closer because I'm paying the bills. But and then he called me up and he said, I don't know if I really took them out. I think I imagined it. And then he said, my food doesn't taste good. And so I raced in New York, and he said, he seemed fine, but he said, I can't eat anything. I think I have some kind of disorder or something. So I arranged for him to see a psychiatrist in Manhattan, and he went in. And that psychiatrist called me, and he said, if you're lucky, your son's on drugs. And I said, what? He said, if you're lucky, your son's on drugs. If not, I think he may have a mental illness. I think he may have bipolar disorder. And, you know, I because of what he said about the drugs, I didn't pay much attention to him, and my son seemed fine, and he gave my son some medication, but after a week, Mike quit taking it, and everything seemed fine. And we went along for months, and everything seemed fine. And then all of a sudden, the roof fell in.
When all this happened, you went, and his mother were divorced.
That's right.
Were you guys able to come together to get him help, or did the discord?
Well, the
continue?
Discord obviously didn't help, and you know, I've remarried, and my wife, his stepmother, was absolutely wonderful. But we did come together. But what you find is that these things put tremendous stress on a family. It not only exacerbated the problem between my ex and I because we didn't agree on things, and she felt at that point she was struggling with self-diagnosed Lyme disease, and she thought he had Lyme disease, and so that added to the problem. But it also creates tension. What happens is after the diagnosis, after you can't get the person help, when you finally do get them help, then you go through a struggle as a family member, and this is pretty universal, of are you enabling, are you setting the bar too high, too low? When we got Mike stable, for instance, is that my ex-wife didn't think he needed to get on disability immediately, and he couldn't work. And I didn't want that for him. Jobs are important, and I wanted him to work. Well, then how much do you expect him to work? Do you expect him to work 40 hours a week, or are you going to work part-time? And so these are the kind of debates you go through. Do you lower your expectations, or because he's taking medication, and in my son's case that helped, do you assume that he can do anything he wants?
And the truth of the matter is, you know, I'm saying this not only as an expert in mental illness, but somebody who works with humans every day in my office, the expectations don't matter anyway. You know, they're just expectations. They have nothing to do with the outcome.
And I think the thing that I, you know, and this was, I think that's pretty typical. You know, since I've written my book, Mike has had two other serious breakdowns. But after that first one, I had, you know, as a parent, you come in, you go, okay, I'll get him to a doctor, and doctors know what to do. I mean, they you take him in, and they have a broken leg, they fix the leg. Well, you don't fix mental illness like right. that, and I didn't know that. And he's been diagnosed as bipolar, schizoaffective, and also early onset schizophrenia. And so pretty soon you just kind of give up on the diagnosis, and you just look at the individual. I think the other thing, besides the frustration with wanting somebody to heal your son and make it like it was, is it never will be that way. And the thing that I had difficulty understanding was the struggle that Mike was having with his own acceptance and understanding that it was his brain and he couldn't trust it. Now, I know that sounds funny, but can you imagine what it's like if you can't trust your own thought process?
Yeah, anybody who's experienced even clinical depression like I have, you know, even a straight down the road clinical depression, your brain, your mind is not under control.
Right.
I mean, so, but yeah, there's...
And that's very frightening, and it's frightening for the family, but it's also very frightening for the person who's gone through it, and sometimes family members forget that. You just, you know, if my son at one point was hearing voices and under delusion, and, you know, my reaction was, stop it. You don't know this. You know, he had a fixation on a movie star. I said, you don't know that person. She doesn't love you. What are you talking about? And that just made the situation worse.
Of course. They just feel more alienated, more misunderstood.
But I also, the system itself is very cruel to parents. There are a lot of doctors who see parents as the problem. They still do. When you go into a situation where your son's psychotic, like mine became psychotic, he broke into a house to take a bubble bath, he ended up getting arrested. When you go to an involuntary commitment hearing, for instance, you are the enemy. Your son immediately gets a lawyer, and they don't want to represent what you want, and they shouldn't. They're representing their client, but they see you as the enemy. And in so many cases, you are the one who's seen as part of the problem, but then when the judge goes away and the lawyers go away and the doctors go away and the social workers go away, you're the one who's standing there with your loved one. And so it just is a system that is not parent family friendly, and that is what is wrong. You need that family connection. And some parents and families just get burned out.
Tell us about that arrest. You alluded to
sure.
When he had a breakdown, he broke into someone's house.
I brought him home from the hospital, and I watched him for 48 hours get sicker and sicker, and I didn't know what to do. I was calling friends. I was calling doctors. It was a holiday, and, you know, I was trying to get him help, and he's sitting and watching the TV with tin foil on his head because he doesn't want the CIA to read his thoughts, and he slipped out of my house, even though I put him in a bedroom and I was sleeping in the hall. He slipped out, and he broke into a stranger's house to take a bubble bath. Luckily, they weren't there. It took five police officers and an attack dog to get him out. And they took him to a mental health center, and I raced over, and a policeman was standing outside, and he said, look, even though your son's broken into a house, take a bubble bath, even though he's told us that he has a mental illness, unless you go in and you tell that doctor that he threatened to kill you, he still won't meet the imminent danger criteria, and we'll take him to jail, and you don't want that.
Did you lie?
I did. I'm not, my son still resents it. He's still angry about it, but I went in and I lied, and I said my son had threatened to kill me, and that was good enough to get him taken to a hospital, and then he voluntarily committed himself 72 hours later. But our problems weren't over then. Within 24 hours, we got a call from his doctor. The insurance company wanted him out. And, you know, I called that insurance company. I got nowhere until I mentioned I used to work at the Washington Post and I'm friends of Mike Wallace of 60 Minutes. Then all of a sudden he was allowed to stay. And I'm telling you that because I violated my professional ethics and I lied, and that was the only way I could get my son help. And that's wrong.
Yeah, it sure is wrong. So tell us about you, Pete. Tell us about how this has changed you.
Well, professionally, it's changed me from a journalist into an advocate. I'm angry. I get upset. I get emotional. This isn't right. You shouldn't take people who are sick and abandon them on the street and let them live under bridges. And we have to find a better way, you know, to protect civil rights but help people. This is wrong. And, you know, when you have your son, I mean, you know, people, we don't think we're going to get a mental illness. Most people don't. You don't. You're not worried you're going to wake up tomorrow and get one.
And yet 25% of this nation does.
That's right. And but what happens when that call is your son and it's your daughter and it's your mother, it's your father, your brother or sister? All of a sudden, that person who's ranting and raving on the street corner who you walk by and you think, get a job or quit using drugs, you know, that's a human face. That's your child. And it makes you angry. And what has made me angrier is in the last 2 years since my book's been published, I've been fortunate enough to visit 45 states and tour 100 programs. And like you, Dan, there are things out there that help people. This isn't a question of not knowing what to do. We know that medication helps in 70% of the cases and other recovery sources, you know, jobs and housing and peer-to-peer and ACT teams and all these things we have developed. Those really can help people live meaningful lives. But we don't do it, and we're not doing it.
Well,
and that's what makes you mad.
All right, let me ask you the same question a little bit differently, and I might get on your nerves because it's going to take you away from
my
your
advocacy.
Mission. Yeah, yeah. So the question was, how has this changed you? And I understand that it's gotten you angrier, it's gotten you to be an effective advocate. But are you a different person than you were
Absolutely.
Before this happened? Tell us how.
Because you're filled with an abiding sadness, because you lose your optimism, because you realize that life isn't fair and that this can happen to anyone, and you're not that special person who's going to be protected. And most of all, as a parent, it rips your guts out because you can't help your child, and that's what it does.
When our producer spoke with you and asked you how Mike was doing now, you said, fantastic. Now, he's 30 years old. This has been going on for 8 years. He's now, even though he's a college graduate, he's living with two other guys who have schizophrenia in a special housing program. He works in a big box store collecting cards. Could you ever have imagined the day you would say having a son working in a big box store would make you feel great?
You know, that's part of what you learn. And I am absolutely thrilled with him. He's happy. He's stable. He is working. Yeah, he's making $8 and whatever cents an hour, and he's living in these conditions. But at least he is stable. And he is talking about moving ahead. He's talking about becoming a peer-to-peer. I mean, he's recognizing this. And the thing that you want, Dan, most of all, is just for him to be stable. You know, because of my book, I've talked to a lot of parents, and, you know, my son's been arrested. My son later got tasered by the police, and I'm lucky. My son's alive, and he when he has a medication that works, and he is fully functional. I mean, he has 50 pounds more than he needs, and he's working on that because we don't want him to get diabetes, and that's caused by the medication. But he's happy, and, you know, I'm happier with him than I am with a son who's a New York principal and doing extremely well. So there you go.
Well, perhaps that is also how you've changed.
Absolutely.
It's expanded your definition of happiness. And
success.
Yeah, and maybe even expanded your definition of love, too, and compassion.
Well, I think that one thing, you have the compassion, and you have the love, and it changes what your definition of success.
Yeah.
But one thing it does is it also teaches you that while love is extremely important, love can't solve this.
Yeah.
I love my son, And I've always loved him. But when he was psychotic, he was a different person.
Yeah, like I say often in my speeches, the Beatles got it wrong. Love is not all you need. You need so much more. Pete, we've got to take a short break. Hang around with us. We're going to talk to you a little bit later. We're going to talk now with Jay Members. He's a 44-year-old man in recovery for both mental illness and substance abuse. He's a full-time student at Community College here in Philadelphia, and he's part of a Philadelphia-based radio station about mental illness and recovery. We'll talk more about that. He's helping break stigma directly. So like I said, we'll be back in 60 seconds. We're talking about mental illness and its impact on the family. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY FM.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY. Headquartered in Philadelphia, Independence Blue Cross is dedicated to the health and well-being of nearly 3 million people throughout the Delaware Valley. Independence Blue Cross now offers individual health insurance plans, including preventative care, emergency care, and prescription drug coverage. Further details available online at ibx4u.com. Independence Blue Cross, here for you every step of the way.
On the next Fresh Air, how new medical breakthroughs are bringing people back to life who were considered brain dead or have been deprived of oxygen. A talk with medical journalist Sanjay Gupta. His new book is called Cheating Death. Also, two baseball Hall of Famers, Reggie Jackson and Bob Gibson, on the classic battle between hitter and pitcher. It's the subject of their new book. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. This is the first of our two-part series on mental illness in America. Today's show is about the human face of mental illness, its impact on families, its impact on individuals. Earlier, we heard from Pete Early, a former Washington Post reporter, author of Crazy, A Father's Search Through America's Mental Health Madness, where he chronicled his experience with his son's mental illness. We're going to be talking more with Pete in just a few minutes, but for right now, we're going to be talking with Jay Members. As I mentioned before the break, he's 44 years old and is in recovery for both mental illness and substance abuse. He's at Philadelphia College full-time, and he's involved in a Philadelphia-based internet radio station to help break stigma. And it's called www.stoprecoveryradio.com. Jay Members, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me there, Dan. Yeah,
thanks for coming out here. So, often this illness shows in late adolescence. Generally, we heard about Pete Early's son. He was in his early 20s. That's when we hear it's 16 to 20, that neighborhood. But you said yours started when you were about 10 or 11?
Yes, that's correct.
With what?
As I recall, it was after my father's death. It was rather traumatic. And I didn't handle it well.
What do you mean?
Well, it was to the extent that we had a normal family. You know, maybe my father was really close. And just one day, he dropped me off from school. And when I came home, he had died of a heart attack. So it was traumatic, and my whole life just changed. It was no more me and him playing baseball in the front yard. Things changed.
What changed inside of you?
It seemed like to me that every time something went well, when it seemed like my life was like everything was perfect, something happened that was traumatic. It changed things. So after a while, when I felt that feeling, I would make irrational decisions.
Like what? What were you doing as a kid?
Like I had transferred for so many schools because if I had made the honor roll or the grades, my mother would congratulate me and be a big thing, and you know, and he was proud of me. The next day, I would get suspended.
For what? What were you doing?
Acting out. Usually it was something of fighting. off the spur, you know, a kid would say something and look at me a funny way, and I would just...
I got a question. I don't know if you can answer from way back then. What was it like on the inside?
It was lonely. I think that's... I felt alone. So I was angry all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. In hindsight, what did you need as a kid?
I needed someone to listen to me and understand.
Yeah.
You know,
like all kids do. So I'm guessing here, I don't know this piece of your history, I'm guessing that because of the loneliness, the anger, the pain, that's where drugs came in. You started using drugs?
Well, at that age, my mother had got me into a child psychology. And I went to therapy. For a while, I was adjusting. They said that, as I remember, they said it was a phase. I was hyperactive. You know, I'll grow out of it. So I started getting into activities. Mother started putting me in activities. Basketball, sports, for the energy. And I was doing well. Started managing. The behavior changed. Now and then, there was little spurts. But when I got to, I'd say about my early teens, I had another mental relapse. And
what did that look like? What happened?
I can't recall. It was a flashback, and I think I real violent, and I tore up my room and everything. And she had to commit me for a minute, and then for a couple of days, and then she sent me to a boarding school.
So you don't remember that episode. So, and then you went to a boarding school. Was it for kids with emotional problems?
No, it was actually, a military school. Yeah, my father was a veteran, so she had got me into a military academy.
Was that helpful or harmful?
It was, I think it was a bit of both. Because I was able to... Be around men mentors. That's what I think.
Yeah.
And learn, you know. I became a little more independent. I started to focus on me, and they were very helpful.
So you said it was both.
Yeah, it gave me some structure.
So what's the downside? What was happening to you on the inside?
The downside was not having the same... sharing the same childhood experience as some of my friends
right.
were.
So there's the alone thing again.
You know, like proms, dates, stuff like that.
Right.
That was, you know, the missing.
You were 44 years old. You had a rough life, apparently, between military school and age 40.
Yeah, it was... a little bit up and down. At times, during that time period, I had some good moments. I went to college. I didn't finish due to my mental illness. I had a basketball scholarship, and things seemed going great. And then once again,
Did you know you had a mental illness?
No, that was a strange thing.
Did anybody tell you you had a mental illness?
Even when I went into the military and I passed the physical and the psychological test and I scored high. And I think that's probably what it was. It was that I scored so high on tests that emotionally they didn't detect it. Because at times I'll be rather calm, serene, and rather... intelligent, I guess, as you want to say. And then I'm in.
Was there a point where you hit bottom, Jay?
After my mother's death.
When was that?
2000.
Your mother sounds like she was quite a lady. I mean, she was very involved in getting you the help you needed.
Yes, she was.
So what happened to you in 2000? To you?
To me, when I had been discharged from the military... around 95, I was married again, family, really didn't adjust well to civilian life. Took me a while to reintegrate back into society.
What was the problem?
I guess I was accustomed to being institutionalized from boarding school, the college, the military. Everything was structured for me.
What happened to you when you got out? What happened inside? What was going on?
I still felt alone. I still felt alone. I didn't know what was going on, why I was making these irrational decisions, why my mood swings were from one spectrum to another. My wife couldn't understand why one day I would come home from work and want to start packing up and moving. And she'll be coming in like, why you got these boxes? Where are we going?
Did you have any inkling that there was something wrong with your mind?
No.
So what happened?
So unfortunately, my wife, my second wife, had she couldn't handle it. And my mother had passed, so she didn't really know much about my childhood and experiences. So we ended up, she had kicked me out, so now I'm on the street, I'm homeless. I'm working and homeless, still unmanageable and living on the street, and then I started to get involved in street drugs and criminal, and that was like, at the time, I didn't understand, it was recreational. Then it got out of control.
Well, did the street drugs help your mind?
To an extent, it's kind of...
I mean, street drugs will certainly cure loneliness, you know?
Yeah, it did, because I remember one of the psychiatrists said that, asked me, when you get high, how do you feel?
Right.
When is the point that you have to... I say, when things are going unmanageable, a lot of things are going on, chaos, everything's stress, and if I go get high or drink, I feel like I level off.
Yeah,
and I can manage everything.
Well, that's why they're a problem, because they work.
Because even in my telling my story, I worked and used to drink and drug.
How did you get help? When? What?
I went to jail. I went to jail. Went to prison. It was a direct result of the lifestyle, drugs, the mental illness, drinking.
Were you diagnosed in prison?
No. And
when did you finally learn that you had a mental illness?
When I got out of prison, my aunt and uncle started to play the surrogate mother and father for me. Mm. And they was very supportive, and I was getting my life back on track. And I was on probation, parole, and eventually I had relapsed mentally and with the drugs and alcohol. And they sought for me to get help, and even my employer did, because they was very supportive too during that time period. Mm. And I went into Horizon House, I believe, for outpatient treatment. And during the assessment, they were giving me group therapy, had a counselor, and I was only thing I was they was focusing on my substance abuse, excuse me, and some of my mental illnesses. But really what happened was I had another severe relapse and ended up homeless and back on the street. And
in hindsight, do you know why you had these relapses? Did you stop taking your medication?
I would stop taking the medication. Wouldn't take it at all. I didn't like the side of the adverse effects.
Yeah. You're taking it now?
Yes. But I'm on different medication than I was.
Less side effects.
Yeah, less side effects.
How do you feel?
I feel comfortable.
Do you?
Yeah.
How's your mind?
Focused. I concentrate better. I'm able to pinpoint things that are going on with me mentally. I'm more aware of like triggers and symptoms.
Yeah, you're probably more aware of your mind than most people.
I'm able to play things back. Things I remember. I couldn't play things back. I would just react. Now I can slow things down and respond more.
All right,
positive.
So I got a really weird question. So stick with me here. Okay. What's your relationship like with your mind now? Like, do you
with my
trust
mind now?
It? Or are you angry at it? Or are you scared of it?
My relationship with my mind now.
Yeah.
It's more. It's cohesive. It's like we partners. Huh. I can trust him. Yeah. I can trust my thinking now. And I never thought of that, Dan. Relationship with my mind.
Yeah.
You know, I sit back and I do a lot of writing, journaling. I'm with a lot of support groups. I have a lot of things I do now that I didn't do.
So let me ask you one last question before we go to break. Tell me about that loneliness thing. Like, where's that? Where'd that go?
I guess I've gotten more spiritual. I think that helped me too. Yeah. I got more spiritual. I see that I'm not alone. Even when I think I'm alone, I'm not.
So the loneliness is not there, or it's not as painful, and nothing on the outside changed.
No.
Yeah, so things don't cure loneliness. Do
no.
They?
Yeah. Yeah, you can. I tried the material stuff and having a whole bunch of so-called friends, and I still.
Oh, we all have. Yeah. We all have. How are you doing in school?
I'm doing pretty well.
Is it hard? Is it hard for you?
No. Now this is my second school year. I've adjusted. The first year was kind of scary.
Yeah,
because I haven't been in school at that capacity for almost like 25 years.
So we've got to take a break, and I'm going to bring Pete Early back, and okay. I want to talk to both of you. But let me just throw a question out there for you to think about. I don't want you to answer it. What can I call you? A consumer? Are you a person with a mental illness? Are you crazy? Do you have a behavioral health problem? Is there any word that feels right, or does it not matter? So I'm just going to put it out there, and we're going to talk about language and stigma.
Okay.
After our break, because I know that's really important for both of you.
Yes, it is.
we are talking about mental illness, the human side of mental illness today on Voices in the Family, the first of our two-part series. We've just been talking with Jay Members. He's a 44-year-old man in recovery with the help of Horizon House. He's a full-time student at Community College of Philadelphia, and he's part of a Philadelphia-based internet radio station about mental illness and recovery that we'll talk about right after our break. And when we come back, we'll be joined again by Pete Early, the former Washington Post reporter and author of Crazy, A Father's Search Through America's Mental Health Madness. And it's in part a memoir about his experience with his own mentally ill son. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. That's right here on WHYY-FM.
Supporting WHYY, St. Joseph's University, offering graduate-level training and organizational development. TOD provides immediately applicable and practical skills and helps advance a student's ability to influence and affect change through leadership. Information and registration for the October 20th TOD Open House is available online at www.sju.edu/TOD. The Master's in TOD at St. Joseph's University. Spirit, intellect, purpose.
I'm Marty Moscowane. At WHYY, we value our editorial independence, and we believe you do too. A rigorous editorial process ensures that the stories you hear are fair, balanced, and accurately reported. That might seem old-fashioned, but it's still the best way to ensure that you can trust what you hear. Help WHYY remain your trusted source for news and information. Call 1-888-345-9499 or pledge online now at whyy.org.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about the human side of mental illness with Jay Members. He's a 44-year-old man in recovery from both mental illness and substance abuse. With the help of Horizon House, if I can give a shameless plug to them, I'm also joined on the phone by Pete Early. He's the author of Crazy, A Father's Search Through America's Mental Health Madness, and which talks, among other things, about his experience with his son's mental illness. So I want to come back to that question, and I want you to weigh in on this also, Pete, this business of language. So, Jay, do you consider yourself crazy, mentally ill, having a mental illness, behavioral health? One of my least favorite labels.
I consider myself Jay Members.
I'll be damned.
I mean, I for me, I think I went through all those phases, and now I'm Jay Members.
Yeah.
You know, and that's how I see it. Went to a fort.
Well, you're not going to get any argument from me. Pete, you chose the word crazy. You said earlier it was to refer to our mental health madness, but
to the system.
To the system. I'm sure you chose that word also to be a bit provocative. What are your thoughts about the language we use or should use?
I think Jay gave you an excellent answer. I don't think people should be defined by their illness. I don't like mentally ill. I don't like consumer, because I think that suggests that it's a choice, and I have enough of a journalism career to know that no newspaper is going to write that someone's a mental illness consumer. And I write for papers, and they won't use that word. I don't think there's anything wrong with patient, because I like patient because it shows that someone has an illness, which is what bipolar, schizophrenia, and major depression are. So, but I'm not the person who's calling the shots on this, and I know in mental health, in the mental health arena, that consumer is the word of choice, but I don't think it is a good choice.
It's hard. You know, words at one level are meaningless, and at another level, they go a long way for stigma. I don't know if you know this, Pete. I'm a quadriplegic, so we've got, you know, the word thing.
I didn't know that.
We've got the word thing going on again.
Sure.
with that. We don't quite know what to say about mental illness, and we don't quite know how to deal with it. I mean, we've sanitized the words so much so that they're meaningless. Now we're calling it behavioral health. Now,
well, I think that the behavioral health and things like brain disorder are attempts to try to get away from the stigma that comes with mental illness. And because the face of mental illness right now isn't Jay, who's a success and doing extremely well. It's not my son. It's the Virginia Tech shooter, and that's what you try to change.
Right. Let's go to the phones. We've got Kate on the line who wants to join the conversation. Kate?
Yes.
Hi. What can we do for you?
Actually, I have a son also who's now 29. He was diagnosed at about 19 with bipolar, but prior to that, you know, when he got his license, you know, he got into tickets, etc., ADD, ADHD, then they say, no, he doesn't have it. Then finally at 19, he had a breakdown, and he was admitted altogether for about a month, and that's when he said that they told him that he had bipolar. Since then to now, he's never really had any taste of success. He got his GED because he didn't graduate, tried college part-time, didn't work. At times I think he's so bright, why can't he function? But he can't. He can't hold a job for more than 4 months, and sometimes he just has to buckle up and do something, but he doesn't.
Kate, is he in treatment?
Well, he's had a lot of cognitive therapy, but right now for the last year and a half, he is not. He said he doesn't need it. He's on medication, which is Depakote, and that's all.
Well, if he's on medication and he's still not doing well, if he's willing to take medication, it might be a time to revisit that if it's not quite holding it, holding him. But I wonder about you, and I can almost hear Pete's mind working here. What about you? What kind of support, guidance are you getting?
Well, none right now. I do talk to friends. I'm pretty vocal. I don't hold things in, but I went to a tough love once, and I didn't agree with their principles, so
right,
I didn't go.
Right.
I just can't do that.
Pete?
I think it'd be good for you to contact your local NAMI, National Alliance on Mental Illness, has a course called Family to Family that will help you deal with some of your anger, because look at the words you're using, and I'm not a psychiatrist, but you're talking about him buckling up, and you're expressing your frustration. And what you need to have a feel for is what all of us have to learn as parents is what the expectations should be. Dan just said he's a quadriplegic. You wouldn't say to Dan, well, buckle up and run, and I don't mean that in a cruel way. Your,
right,
your son
course.
Has a mental illness, and you have to understand what his limitations are and how far he can do it. One of the frustrating things is people say to people in depression all the time, well, just pull mm-hmm. yourself out of it. Well, you can't do that. So if you go to NAMI, they have a family. Kind of helps you. It helped me a lot in kind of evaluating where my expectations should be, because my son was good at manipulation, and so I had to learn how to put that, see when he was just taking an excuse and letting his mental illness be excuse, and when he really could do something and he couldn't do something.
I would like to share with you, Kate, and you, Pete, and Jay, that I have a loved one with a mental illness, and that person said to me once, in the midst of their crisis, I feel like I am a diamond inside a malignant tumor. And it's something for all of us to keep in mind with our loved ones, is that that diamond is in there. You can guarantee that the diamond is in there, and all the rest of it is not that he's a bad guy or a manipulator or a con artist, but those are all symptoms of that malignancy around his mind that needs help. Kate, I wish you the best for both you and your son. Peter, I wonder what advice you have for families in general about how to cope with loved ones.
Well, picking up on what you just said, Dan, I think it's important because when you see somebody who has a physical illness, you immediately have a sense of, your understanding of it. When you're dealing with somebody with a mental illness where they look normal and everything seems fine, then you get frustrated and you get angry. And I think the thing you have to do is NAMI, Mental Health America, Jay talked earlier about support groups. You can't solve these on your own. You need help from other people, and you need the support of others who have been down this path. I rely tremendously on NAMI because I'm a parent and it fits me well. But in the support of your family, but the toughest issues are what Kate was just talking about, is trying to decide where the enabling begins. And I never bought tough love either.
And
so.
That's that does not work for this. And that's where group support comes in. When we help you to find those lines. Jay, I'd like to see you weigh in on this. What would you advise that mother? Moreover, what would you advise her son?
Oh, I have to agree. The family support groups. Here in Philadelphia, we have the Family and Partnership and Mental Health, and I've seen how that has grown, where family members come together and share their experiences as working with the system. Working with their loved one, getting identification and support from other family members, and sharing their stories helped them. I had partaken in one of their family storytelling trainings that Department DBH had held workshop, And it was very enlightening.
DBH?
Yeah, Department of Behavioral Health.
Behavioral Health.
Yeah.
I've been mentioning this throughout the show. Tell us, we've only got a minute left. Tell us about your radio program, the show, how we can find it.
It's an internet radio show. It's www.stop-recoveryradio. Stop is sobriety through outpatient. It's located in the North Philadelphia area. My show is called Young People in Recovery for me, because I came in with a full of life. I try to touch on the different pathways of recovery, and also I try to break the stigma that people with mental health and substance abuse have in society, and showing a different light. You know, my show is rather lighthearted. At times, we have a lot of different topics.
Good for you.
You know.
Good for you. Well, listen, I got to tell you, we are out of time, Jay. When you first came in, I thanked you for coming in. Now I give you an extra thanks, because it's been great getting to know you and hearing your story. We've been talking about mental illness on today's show and trying to put a human face on it. My guest has been Pete Early, a former Washington Post reporter and author of Crazy, A Father's Search Through America's Mental Health Madness. Pete, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Dan.
And Jay Members says, recovery from both mental illness and substance abuse. Next week on Voices in the Family, join us for part two in our series, Living with Mental Illness, as we explore mental health policy issues in America. And by the way, make sure to tune in tomorrow night at 10 p.m. to WHYY Channel 12 for a special TV program called Minds on the Edge. It'll feature a panel of experts, including Pete Early, on how mental health issues affect individuals, families, and communities. Tomorrow, please join me on my web chat as we continue the discussion. It'll be philly.com/askdan. It'll be a live web chat with a mother whose mentally ill son took his own life 6 months ago. Well, if you've got a story idea or a comment or reaction, you can email us at voices@whyy.org or contact me directly at drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez Luna is our executive producer of audio content. Mike and Scott's our executive producer. Stephanie Marudas was our producer for today's show. Alisa Walters is our associate producer. Our intern is Jonathan Glick. Yuna Kwan is our volunteer. Me, I'm Dan Gottlieb, the host. Enjoy your week, my friends.
You've been listening.